Democracies find it difficult to wage wars cynically, George F. Kennan has said. Indeed, we find it difficult to do anything cynically, and this inhibition does us credit, even when it manifests itself in the form of that hypocrisy which is the tribute that vice traditionally pays to virtue. But it also does us credit to be honest and to face facts. We shall act to better effect if we know why we are acting and what we are in fact doing. We need not be ashamed of our ultimate purposes. The world will be a vastly better place for everybody if we achieve our purposes than it can possibly be if we fail. We can seek to further them in good conscience, and this fact will help us further them. Our strength may not be as the strength of 10 because our hearts are pure. Whose heart is pure? But it will be a greater strength if we need not be ashamed of ourselves, and we need not. We must know what kind of a world it is we live in and how it functions and how we therefore must comport ourselves and what we have a right to expect of it and of any given course of action and what we do not have any right to expect. We must understand causal relationships. If we do, we won't be shocked and hurt and disillusioned and embittered when the natural laws of world politics assert themselves. We won't cry out, "You can't do this to me." We won't search for scapegoats and accept any which demagogues offer up to us. We won't hide our heads under the covers and think thereby to isolate ourselves from the world. I revert to the thesis, or the hypothesis, which I propounded at the outset. We must all think more in terms of underlying realities, and above all, of the chief underlying reality, which is power. Those of us who teach must teach more in these terms, I respectfully submit. Those who report must report more in these terms. Those who formulate and execute policy must think and act more in these terms. You may say that all of this is self-evident. I devoutly wish I could agree, but I cannot. I have had too many experiences on this score to be optimistic about it. Let me cite two of them. Two of the highest-ranking officers in the Department of State were scheduled some time ago to take part in a roundtable type of radio program together on our Greek policy. One of the men is a professional career diplomatist, one of the ablest I've ever known. The other is one of those broad-gauge outsiders with a fresh approach who are constantly being appointed to high office in American diplomacy because, presumably, of their capacities in other fields of endeavor. In discussing plans for the broadcast in advance, the broad-gauge outsider with the fresh approach said that he planned to make it quite clear during the program that, of course, our policy in Greece was purely economic and had no connection with what he called political policy, an immortal term if I ever heard one. The professional diplomatist thought, of course, that his distinguished colleague was joking. How, he asked, can a foreign economic program be considered as something separate and altogether apart from other aspects of foreign policy? But the broad-gauge outsider with a fresh approach was in deadly earnest. He was offended by the attitude of his professional colleague, and he made it clear that he would insist on his point in the broadcast. Once convinced that the man really meant what he said, the professional threw up his hands in despair and refused to take part in the program. He could not, he said, be a party to such nonsense. The outsider, unhappily, found another officer in the Department of State who was willing to participate in the public utterance of these absurdities, and the program went on the air. Permit me to cite one further example. I myself once expressed the view at a sociable luncheon at the National Press Club that it was a pity that one of the most important single principles of American foreign policy had never been given a name which would make it easy for everybody to remember it. Parenthetically, I may say that this incident took place before there was any such thing as the North Atlantic Treaty. Most Americans have heard of the Monroe Doctrine, I said, and have at least some general idea of what it is or what it was all about. A good many Americans have a vague notion of John Hay's open door policy. But, said I, there is a principle of our policy which is more important than either of these, and yet few people consciously realize that the principle exists, partly because it has no name. That is, of course, the principle that we must always do everything we possibly can to prevent the domination of the eastern shores of the Atlantic by a single hostile power. This argument of mine elicited only troubled looks from my luncheon companions. One of these companions was the editor of an out-of-town newspaper. The other was a Washington correspondent who has been writing about national and foreign affairs for a good many years. Neither is now or ever was employed by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I might say, at this juncture. My fellow correspondent asked me what I meant. I said, by way of illustration, that this country had gone to war twice in my lifetime, for the purpose, among others, of preventing Western Europe from falling under hostile domination. The other correspondent was astonished and outraged. "That's not why we went to war in 1917," he said. "Then why did they?" I inquired. "Why did we?" I inquired. "Because of the sinking of the Lusitania," he replied. At this point, up spoke the editor. "You've been away from your own country a long time, haven't you?" he asked. I admitted that this was indeed the case. "Maybe your editors ought to send you back to Chicago to cover police courts for 6 months to get your American point of view back again," said the editor. I do not think that the dialectics of power are self-evident. I do not flatter myself that I have succeeded this evening in doing conspicuously well what I have said I think needs to be done. I don't think I do it very well in my reporting for the Post-Dispatch either, for that matter. I can only say again, as I said at the outset, that I hope it is possible, as I am persuaded it is important, to formulate the problem and to indicate a possible line of approach to a solution of the problem, which better qualified students may perfect. I admit that this may be asking a lot of you others. In defense, I can only tell you that in Washington, we deal frequently in terms of what is called policy guidance. I suppose I am, in a way, offering you policy guidance. To explain what is meant in Washington by policy guidance, I should like, with your permission, to repeat a story which Charles M. Spofford, the chairman of the Council of Deputies of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, told at a luncheon the other day in Washington. Spofford had just been called home from London, where the Council of Deputies sits, for policy guidance, and he told us this story apropos. As the first bitter winds of winter began to blow, the grasshopper found himself, improvident as always, without provision for the hard season which lay ahead, and went to the ant. How, he asked the ant, was he to survive the winter? You must change yourself into a cockroach, replied the ant unhesitatingly. Then you can seek out a warm, comfortable kitchen, live on the fat of the land all winter, and when spring comes, change yourself back into a grasshopper again. The grasshopper was extremely grateful for this sage counsel. He shook the ant warmly by the hand, expressed his gratitude, and turned to go. Then, however, he did what in Hollywood we call a double take. He bethought him of something which had not occurred to him up to that moment, and he turned back to the ant. But how, he inquired anxiously, am I to change myself into a cockroach? Listen, said the ant with some asperity. The details are up to you. All I can give you is policy guidance.